For some personalities, the 9 to 5, go to work, go home, don't take work home with me, that's considered heaven to some people. For me, that's considered hell. I sold my financial advice business, had a big amount of money in the bank account and a podcast that wasn't really making money. I'm like, okay, we're all in. I tried a lot of stuff and wasted a lot of money before, you know, this current thing made money and worked. I'm being dramatic, but behavior gets people into problems and behavior will get people out of problems. Are not actually ready to change, don't waste your time. Like, you need to hit rock bottom. You need to be like, I've actually had enough of living week to week. I've had enough of this credit card debt. If you're not ready to, if you're not ready to give up smoking and you enjoy too much, keep smoking. Like, why put yourself through it?
I'm Frances Cook. Welcome to Making Sense, supported by KiwiBank. Learning how to invest has to be one of the top questions I get in my inbox each week. And I love investing. It's one of the fun parts of taking control of your money, to see it grow as well. But of course, there are pitfalls, and you need to have your financial house in order before you give it a whirl. So how do you avoid the bear traps? Let's talk to someone who's ready to drop more than a few truth bombs. And welcome, Glenn James from the Money, Money, Money podcast. Or also, people might know you as being formerly My Millennial Money, author of the Quick Start Guide to Investing as well. We'll be getting into more on that soon. But I've got to say, as shown in your podcast title, Money, 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 you spend all day talking things money. Everyone starts somewhere, though. Where did you first catch that money, money, money bug?
Well, I don't know. I think from a young age, even in my teens, I was interested in personal finance. And I remember when I was 15 years old, once I looked at a community college thing in the newspaper, and there was like, on Saturday, we're doing a share investing session, come along. And I rocked up with all these retirees and talking about shares in the community college. And I don't know, it was always, I just always had an interest in personal finance, and I don't know where it came from. So I've just continued to always follow my interests, follow my passions, and turned it into a career. So I'm, you know, fortunate enough, I guess, like you, we are doing what we love for a living, and it doesn't feel like work. And it's not easy to get to that position, but it's certainly worth it if you can.
Yeah, I've got to say, it's funny because I couldn't necessarily tell you when I first got interested in money either, but I can tell you exactly what it hooks into for me emotionally. And I wonder if that's what keeps me interested. To me, it's all about that freedom and independence. I don't like other people being able to tell me what to do. Is there something that emotionally keeps you hooked in the money world and keeps you interested?
Well, I think a big part of it is, you know, one of my values is autonomy. And like many people who run their own business or have been self-employed, we generally don't like rules. We don't love, you know, being restricted to things. And for some personalities, the 9 to 5, go to work, go home, don't take work home with me, that's considered heaven to some people. For me, that's considered hell. So I think maybe it is that autonomy thing. If I can understand money, if I can manage it well, if I can build my life where I'm not trading my time for money, and that's a big thing that's really hard to get to, I should be able to do what I want, when I want, if I want.
Yeah. Was it something, you know, you said that you've always been interested in it. Was it talked about at home when you were a kid, or did you end up finding this interest by yourself later on in life?
It wasn't talked about at home. The only memories I've got talking about money at home were when we would see ads on TV, like credit cards advertised, or you see credit cards in pop culture and people like just buying on the credit card. I remember as kids, like my sister and I would always like tell mum and dad, oh, we should get a credit card. You know, we can buy stuff and that'd be so awesome. And dad was always like, if you don't have the money, you don't buy it. Like, simple. And my parents never had a credit card their whole life. And I really hate consumer debt. And I think that was just drummed into me from a young age. You know, it's this wild concept, isn't it? If you don't have the money, you can't buy it. What? How offensive, Glenn. Why are you telling me that? I can't buy this? What? No, you don't have the money. You can't buy it.
It's wild, though, that they had those ads that you were exposed to as a kid. You know, I think about things like we have restrictions on tobacco ads. You know, you can't have things like that advertised. Or even if there are some adverts around, it's very tightly controlled how and when and who can be exposed to it. And yet, credit cards and these financial tools that can be very dangerous are freely advertised. And you as a kid were getting the message of, oh, I'd like to buy things with that.
And not understanding the gravity of it as well.
Yeah.
You know, in Australia at the moment, there's this big debate happening with gambling ads. And because it just rips through everywhere, like sports bet apps and all that stuff. Forget going to the RSL pub or casino. You've got a poker machine in your pocket if you want it. And this stuff is like financial cancer. And I'm just wondering, like these kids that are watching the games and football games, like during halftime, we've got odds. Like, is a kid going to be growing up and talking with their friends at school? Yeah, I picked a good multi or whatever they call it on the weekend. And it's just so bad. And these bans can't come soon enough with this stuff, particularly if you look at the impact on kids.
Yeah. So when your parents were talking to you about this stuff, obviously they drummed into you to be careful with debt. That's not a bad start. That's a better start than a lot of people get.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't heed the advice first, but...
And then you took off and started looking into shares well. What did your parents think when you were taking off and looking into shares? Did you tell them? Did they think that was weird?
Yeah, well, they dropped me off at the community college. So they were like, oh, that's cool. He's involved. And it's weird because I always really liked the idea of small business. And in high school, one of the top subjects that I did was business studies. And it was just so weird. Like in year 11, the business studies curriculum, when they were talking about sole trader or a company and all this stuff, I already knew it just from like reading stuff. And so there was just something in me. And I don't know why. I guess, you know, some people that are really good at music and guitars and all that, they're like, oh, I'll just pick up the guitar one day and played it. Like, I've got a friend who plays guitar very well and he was self-taught and he can't read music. Like, I think we all just have different things that we pick up from a young age and it just activates something in us and we become a sponge and just always learn and understand that thing.
And then you became a financial advisor. Was that a linear career progression? You just decided, this is time, I'm going to dive into the money world and I'm going to turn it into my career. Or did it take you a while to get there?
It took a little while. So it's been very interesting, even the last 6 months, where I received a formal diagnosis with ADHD and have since been medicated and it's changed my life, to be honest. And I'm like, far out, wish I would have had that 20 years ago. But I actually left school after year 11 and I was only allowed to leave school if I got a trade. So I left school at age 16 and did an apprenticeship in telecommunications. And then all the way through that, I was always still thinking, it's like, I can't do this long term because I can't trade my time or my physical body for money. I need to use my brain. I need to try and have a system where I can earn money while I sleep. And that's been really ingrained in me since I was a teenager. So I finished my apprenticeship, had to have some major ankle surgery, and then I was literally on the lounge in a cast for 8 weeks. And, you know, if you want to slow me down, give me ankle surgery and make sure I can't walk. And, you know, that was slow. And particularly because I'm such a doer, I really needed that to slow me down. So I had heaps of space and I was still living at home and I was, you know, 20 years old. And I'm like, I reckon I should study money. Use this. I finished the apprenticeship. I'm off work. Use this as a flashpoint to do something else. So I enrolled in a diploma of financial services, financial planning, and then looked for a job in a financial planning office and basically did another apprenticeship, did 4 and a bit years doing that. And then I started my own business doing financial advice where I was from, because I was commuting to Sydney an hour each day. And yeah, did my own business for 10 years. And yeah, and then I started the podcast while I was still financial planning and still had the financial planning business. And then it, then I changed.
Yeah, because now I'd say you're more of a, I mean, everyone has their own label for it, but to my mind, you're more of a financial communicator / educator.
Yeah.
So why make that switch? Because especially in Australia, those two things can be quite different, right?
Mm. So I'd done my financial planning business for 10 years and I built it up from scratch, individual clients, just one by one, like just didn't borrow money and bought a book of clients, didn't buy another business, just from scratch. And my personality is that I'm a builder, right? So there's, in kind of the business world, there's things like minders and finders. So, you know, I'm a finder. I just need to go out and find the work, do it. And then you've got the other personality that kind of mines and cultivates. And I wasn't that type of personality. I'm a builder. I'm a doer. I'm a get out there. I need a mountain to climb. I can't tend to the garden at base camp. I need to conquer new areas that we can build a garden. And I'm done. I'm like, I've got a really good, successful business here. I make good money. I've got a really good lifestyle. And then on the other side, the podcast thing, you know, I started at the time, My Millennial Money. There was no kind of mainstream personal finance podcast by Aussies for Aussies at the time. And that's why I started it. And then I really leaned into it. And then kind of 6 or so months as a bit of a crossover, I'm like, this has legs. This has an opportunity. I'm going all in. So I sold my financial advice business, had a big amount of money in the bank account and a podcast that wasn't really making money. I'm like, okay, we're all in. And it was a big risk to try and live off your own savings for a couple of years and build this new thing. So it was a start. I did start it because there was a need. It was a hobby. It was a side hustle that I did to make my life a bit more exciting. And then that took my attention and my focus. And then I thought, well, I'll just go all in online, because I've always wanted an online business. And I think I'm as you said, like a financial commentator, a podcaster, money dude. I actually say I just run an online business. That's what I do, because I like the business side of it more. And, you know, sometimes I get bored of doing a podcast and it's like, far out, what I'm going to say today, and I'm over this and it's not going anywhere. But I just, yeah, I love the business side of it. And we've got, I think, 6 other podcasts within my kind of business, and I've got a team of 7 people, and it kind of hums along pretty good. It's the lifestyle business for me, and we do a 4-day work week, so the team get a 3-day weekend every week. So yeah, I just wanted it to work. And we've got a bit of a rule in the business where we don't really do urgent. So nothing's mission critical or time critical. Maybe a couple times a year, if there's a big news breaky thing, I'll jump on and get an episode up. But we just want to chill. We want to look after our audience. And we've got a really good Facebook community. And yeah, it's been great. So that's kind of how I got to right now.
It sounds like you started out a lot younger than I did, with an idea of how you could use money to create a lifestyle for yourself. Because you mentioned about even thinking as a teenager that you wanted this idea of making money while you were asleep. And totally agree with you now. I only came across that idea in my late 20s, and it was revolutionary to me. Like, nobody had ever mentioned this possibility. It wasn't even a thought. It wasn't even a thought of, oh, I couldn't do that. It was literally not on my radar. And then, you know, you're really interested in the online business. And I late to the game on everything. I have, you know, come to that only in the last few years and realize this is amazing. Everything is online now. Why aren't I? You know, how did you get into these things at this young age? You know, was it just that you were keeping an eye on things and you sort of picked it up by osmosis, who knows where? Or were you looking into things, researching and thinking, ah, follow down this rabbit hole? You know, where did all this come from?
I think just an internal curiosity to see if I could do it. Because I like an intellectual challenge and I like systems, I like processes. I mean, I tried a lot of stuff and wasted a lot of money before, you know, this current thing made money and worked. Like, I had a podcast before My Millennial Money that sucked, that I just stopped and like, nah, need to go a different direction. In 2011, I tried to make, at the really start of the app world, I tried to make some kids apps. Well, we made a couple of kids apps. So, because I wanted to make my niece an app for the iPad. So I got a team together and we made apps and did all that because I wanted to try and crack that. I tried to do pet supplies online, just selling pet products, like as a business. I started an Instagram account. I think it's still up. It's probably dwindling, but at the time it was pretty good, like had like over 10 or 11,000 followers, and I called it Pet Love Official and just try to like, okay, if you can make money from stuff that people want to spend money on, and that's like kids or pets. And so I tried it all.
You're into pulling the heartstrings.
Yeah. And then I was kind of thinking like, hang on, what about I focus on what my wheelhouse actually is? And that's personal finance. And I was even thinking the other day, like my strength really is having someone who's in a financial mess come to me. They do my online course. It's free now, like the Glenn James Spending Plan. Get some systems and get onto a track, get their foundations in order, and then hopefully learn and change and outgrow the stuff that I've told them. I'm really good at helping beginners get started with stuff, whether that's investing, whether that's budgeting. I'm not really a let's talk about this company today and do share trading and all that crap. Like, I'm really good at making the complex simple for people.
Yeah, I've got to say, I understand how people get interested in those more complicated parts of money. I get it. It can be fun. But 90% of what's needed for people is actually that simple core stuff. I mean, I was looking through your new book. It's great, by the way, spoiler alert. But you talk about there being six common pitfalls from trying to manage our money. And I think some of them might be controversial for people. I want to go through them one at a time and why you're not a fan of debt consolidation. Tell me more.
Yeah, so if you don't know what debt consolidation is, because there are still people that don't know that term, it could be I've got a car loan, I've got a personal loan, I've got a credit card. I got to pay the debt off. So you go to the bank or the lender and you merge all the three debts into the one debt. Or if you've got a mortgage, you might refinance the mortgage and then pay off the other loans. And then you've got a lower payment and maybe a lower interest rate. The reason I'm not a fan of that is because the reason people have consumer debt is because systematically over a long period of time, they've overspent. And if you've got a credit card and there's $3,000 owing and you just can't shake it, it's not because you purchased the one $3,000 lounge. It's not the one $3,000 flight holiday. It's death by a thousand cuts, one small thing at a time, year on year. We're just overspending and the result of that has to land somewhere, and that's on credit card. Why I say don't default to debt consolidation is because you've done that. You think that you've solved the problem. Oh, I've fixed this. I've consolidated my debt. I'm on track now. No, you've just moved the debt. And it probably will take you longer to pay it off because you might have pushed out the payment term. You might put it on the mortgage. And sure, it's a lower interest rate, but a lower interest rate for a longer period of time, probably worse than a higher interest rate for a short amount of time. So my thing is, interest rate isn't your problem. You overspending systematically for a longer period of time is the problem. And I just recommend, yeah, a bit of a like a debt snowball technique there where, you know, we put everything on minimum payments, we list the debt smallest to largest, and then we just attack the small debt first, regardless of the interest rate. And you might say, Glenn, why would I pay the smaller interest rate off before the higher interest rate? That doesn't make any sense. Well, my friend, it doesn't make sense to have debt at higher interest rates. So what about you try my way for a minute and behavior got yourself into this problem. Behavior needs to get you out of this problem. So with due respect, don't tell me what a bad thing to do with money is, because you're the one with high interest rate credit cards that you can't shake. And I'm being dramatic, but behavior gets people into problems and behavior will get people out of problems.
Yeah, all right. So debt consolidation to you is almost like the opposite of lighting the fire under you. It is removing that motivation to get yourself out of the hole you've dug because you've given yourself a false reassurance.
Yeah, well, you just haven't changed anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, you haven't changed anything.
Yeah.
You've just moved the debt. You need a budget. You need a spending plan. You need to have a system. So, because a lot of the time, in my anecdotal experience of dealing with hundreds of people face-to-face, coaching them out of debt, they clean up the debt. 10, 11 months, 12 months later, they're back in debt because nothing's changed. Just the debt has been moved.
Okay. But of course, you're saying you need a system, but you're not a fan of zero-based budgeting. That's another of the pitfalls. Why not zero-based budgeting?
Yeah, not in the first instance. I think it could work if you're highly analytical. You might be an engineer, you might be a school teacher, like those types of personalities that are very measured and controlled and can actually go.
So not me.
Or me. Where I believe in my budgeting, life's too short to kind of look back and go, oh, what did I spend at the cafe the last month? Like, who cares? Like, we've got to live. So when I teach my spending plan, it is just about having a system and having a structure. And we say, look, let's get a separate bank account that we can have just for food, fuel, going out, lifestyle, just week on week stuff that we pay. Let's just pick a number, $300 a week, whatever that is. Let's have a separate account from the other and a separate bank, different bank itself. So our pay goes into our main cash hub. Then we just transfer a weekly amount over to the spending account and just use that. Pay yourself weekly into your spending, whether you get paid weekly, fortnightly, or monthly. And these things will help rather than saying, it's akin to like dieting, right? It'd be akin to me saying, well, if you want to lose weight, don't eat more than 1,800 calories a day. Don't eat more than 1,500 a day. What about we start by just saying, I'm only having ice cream on Saturday. That's all we're going to do. We just need to start this behavioral change.
Yeah, that sounds a lot like what I refer to as chunking in some of my education, where this is the only thing that's ever worked for me. This is the system I like. I give people a few different budgeting systems, but I like chunking for myself, where I will have, as you say, that, I don't know, $100, $200, whatever works for your budget. And you say, this is my money that I can spend and it's no problem, and it goes on whatever it goes on, and once it's gone, it's gone. And I've also got that chunk going into savings and whatever. And it's just a lot easier to keep track of, isn't it? Especially at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, because I don't want to have to use my brain. I just want to say, I've got X amount this week. I'm personally happy if I have a big dinner out on a Tuesday night, and because I transfer my money on a Wednesday, my weekly spend money, I'm happy Wednesday for lunch, have a bowl of cereal at home because I got no money left. Like that's, and what it actually does is if you do chunk that amount of money to the weekly spend, I say a different bank, not just a different account. It's got to be completely separate, and you don't have the other bank with all your other money on your phone or those cards in the wallet. So you're out there in the wild. You've just got your weekly spend account. And what it does, it gives the spenders like me some guardrails. So spend whatever you want of this money this week, knock yourself out, but that's it. But it also gives the savers permission to spend. And that's a big thing. You're allowed to buy a coffee without feeling guilty.
guess it's actually, that's so interesting that you say that. I was just listening back earlier today to a different interview that I recorded, and she was saying that she actually was a really good saver. She's got such great saving tips, but she struggled to spend. And I actually genuinely believe that spending is as much of a skill as saving is. You've got to enjoy your life as well, right? On that, I mean, we've touched on this a little bit, but the third of your six pitfalls, strategic credit card spending, why does that catch people out?
I mean, the only reason credit card exists is because on balance, most people most of the time can't pay their balance off and they pay interest. Sure, there might be 5 or 10% of cardholders. I actually need to get the actual data on that, but on balance, most people spend more and they need to make interest payments. And that's subsidizing the rewards that the other small percentage is getting. And the actual data shows, there is research, you can Google this, anyone, the experiments where people have used credit versus their own money or even cash. When Macca's in America first put FPOS machines in and credit cards, people were spending 12% more on average when they were using credit because there's no pain. It's not your money. And people are like, oh, I do it for the points. I'm like, oh, do you? Okay, well, the best way to get the most out of points is using them for flying, not buying a new Dyson through Qantas or whatever. And you take one flight every 2 years. I'm sorry, you're not a frequent flyer. You don't have to use, I mean, I'm at the stage, I don't care what anyone does with their money. But if you ask me, if you want financial success, don't gamify your spending with credit cards and points. Now, I'm actually, as we record this, I'm doing a bit of a real-time experiment in my life because I want to just experiment, and I'm going to share that with my audience in the coming weeks to do with credit cards.
Cool. So keep an eye out for that. Where can people find that if they want to follow along with that experiment?
Oh, it would just be on the Money, Money, Money podcast. So yeah, I've done something a bit controversial just to try, and I'm going to kind of, I think I've finished my experiment. Yeah. And that's it. Like, I understand you could be that person who can zero-base budget, who is very frugal and do all that. Sure. You can use a credit card responsibly. I get that. But most of us can't. I'm sorry. And it's okay not to have a credit card. It's okay not to do things for the points. Like, the best way to use points is for flights. I fly a lot for work. I use credit in the business. My business has Amex cards because all my leaders in the business, you know, have got Amex cards because it's just easy. They can just pay. I can see on the statement who's done. Like, yeah, I'll pay business expenses with it because I can get a business upgrade for 10,000 points from Sydney to Melbourne. Yeah, I'll do that, whatever. Not paying extra. We had to pay $5,000 for the email subscription anyway. So whatever, but I just don't use it day on day for personal spending because it just doesn't work.
Yeah, I had someone message me the other day saying, oh, you know, I'm really worried. People tell me I should have a credit card for the credit history, but it makes me nervous. I don't like it. And it is interesting, isn't it? Because for starters, the credit history thing is something that's leaked over from American content. That's important for Americans, not New Zealand and Australia. But also the second one is, you know, oh, I feel worried about it. Oh, I don't like it. Well, that's your gut instinct telling you something. And the reason it worries you is because most people can't handle credit cards. That's how they're designed. That's how they're still in business, right?
And I like to say, I don't know your age, and I'm not going to try and do stuff, but
very diplomatic.
Older people like me, right? I used to do this in my content, but my audience is just too young now. You may remember the old illusionists from Vegas, Siegfried and Royd, okay? They had the white tiger, or was it a lion? One of them, on the stage.
Tiger? I'm not sure now.
I think it was the white tiger. And for years on years and years, they had the residency in Vegas at the casino, right? And they had the white tiger. It came in, came out, tamed the tiger, okay? Guess what actually ended up happening Tiger mauled one of them live on stage. The tiger is designed to maul flesh and people and anything, really. That's what it's designed for. You can tame that for as long as you want. We all watched Tiger King. He had a few little...
Yeah.
Now, credit cards. Mark my words. You may be able to control it, but get this. One day, it will bite you. It's okay. Like, you do you, but personal finance is personal. And if you don't want a credit card, it's okay. Don't have one. Tell everyone to get stuffed. It's your life. It's your money.
Oh, I'm so with you. Yeah, exactly. Don't be mad when the tiger does what it's meant to do. Don't be mad when the credit card does what it's meant to do. This is how these companies are in business and employ a bunch of people. Okay, so you also don't like paying down debt before having an emergency fund. Why is there an order to that that should be different?
My first question is, why are you painting me to be this negative Nancy?
You're just so mean to us. You tell us no all the time.
Oh, man. Okay, so...
We'll get to the positive soon, I promise.
Yeah, we will try. Well, maybe not, actually. So if you're, you know, you've got the three credit card debts or a personal loan, a couple of credit cards or a store card, we need to change something. So what I encourage people to do, let's just minimum payments on the credit cards, even if it's 3 or 4 months, minimum payments. Guess what? You're paying interest. Yep, that's all right. You're not in a good financial position anyway. Try my way for a while. We should be able to get you out of there because we've got to change the behavior. Let's build a starter emergency fund, $2,000, $1,500, just some type of buffer. Then we go and attack the debt because if something goes down, the last thing we want to do is go back to credit. We just want to use that cash that you've got saved. Now, this, if you are in a financial mess, this system with having a spending plan, they need to work together. We need some type of plan. In my first book, Sort Your Money Out, I actually told people, like, if you are not actually ready to change, don't waste your time. Like, you need to hit rock bottom. You need to be like, I've actually had enough of living week to week. I've had enough of this credit card debt. If you're not ready to, if you're not ready to give up smoking and you enjoy too much, keep smoking. Like, why put yourself through it? But you've got to hit this rock bottom. And I even want you to set up your new budget system, move the debt to minimum payments, no extra payments, even for a few weeks, few months, and just run the new money system because we have to change the behaviors.
Yeah, that's exactly it, isn't it? So much of money is, I think that's often where people do go wrong with money, is they're too focused on the numbers, on the dollars. It's good to know that stuff. That stuff is part of the journey. Of course it is. But there's also the thing of, I'd say a good 80% of it is mindset and behavior, and not in a woo-woo sort of just like think your way to success. But you know, you have to understand yourself and your triggers and what's happening. And I think if people don't have that emergency fund to help them when life continues happening as you're paying off that debt, it's a huge demotivating factor if you have to take on more debt as you're trying to pay it off, right?
Yeah. Money works. Investing works. People don't. And this is the whole thing. You, like the whole, I think the first two chapters of the new book, even maybe three chapters, it's not like, here, do this and invest. It's like, well, let's actually set up a structure and a way to invest. So once that money is invested, it can stay invested. Investing works. People don't. Money works. People don't. Health and fitness work. I could lose weight if I actually wanted to and if I actually tried. But I'm lazy and I like good stuff. And I can't whinge because we lay in the bed we make for ourselves. The problem I've got is I live in reality, and it's offensive to say you've got debt because you overspend. It's offensive to say don't use credit card if you don't actually want to. It's offensive to say you're not a frequent flyer, you fly twice a year or twice or once every 2 years or whatever. This stuff's offensive, but I actually live in reality, and I want my listeners to live in reality as well.
It is that tricky thing, right, where trying to help people make a change, if they want to make that change, like you say, right, that if you don't want to make a change, that's fine. It's your life. But I always have the rule of you're allowed to complain if you're doing something about it. If you don't want to do anything about it, that's fine. but please don't complain, you know, because you're making that choice, right?
Yeah, it's very interesting. And it's that whole, to a point, you can choose to be a victim or actually go and do something about your situation. Now, I know it's hard. We talk a lot about, you know, work and career, and the book I wrote after the money book was the Sort Your Career Out book, right? And I said, this is kind of the prequel to all the money books, because the best investment you can ever make is your career. And I tell people, you know, you might not love your job or career at the moment. It could be very hard, and it is very hard to make a pivot. So it's actually, again, we live in reality. It might not happen tomorrow or in 2 months or 6 months. But what we can do is start to think, what do I want my life to look like in 2 years? And I need to put a plan in place. So in 2 years, guess what's happening? The time's going to pass anyway. So how can we do micro things that cumulative effect of that ends in a different spot? And this whole thing is very similar to cause and effect. If you want something to happen in your life, you just have to understand cause and effect. If I want a dwarf lemon tree to grow out the back here on my balcony, I can wish about it all day long. Or I can make a list, the causes for that effect to happen. I've got to drive to the big green shed. That's Bunnings. I've got to buy pots. I've got to buy plants. I've got to actually put these multiple steps in place to get the effect that I'm sitting here wishing about. Now, it could be hard for some people to actually get a dwarf lemon tree on their balcony. I get that. Could be hard for people. But you can actually write a bit of a list and start to think, in the next 2 years, I would like to have that dwarf lemon tree. So I need to actually put a plan in place. I just need everyone to know, with any of your money stuff and life and career stuff, it's not easy, but it is worth it if you're not happy with where you are at the moment.
That's the thing, is that acknowledgement of, we all do start in different places and there are different things that could be difficult that are totally real. But at the same time, unfortunately, nobody comes to rescue you, right? So you have to put in these plans. Now, going back to investing, I'm going to combine these last two points because I think it makes for a good sort of launch into us talking about investing more broadly. So you also say it can be a mistake to invest in shares too soon. And also, once you get there, to only invest in quality companies. Why are these issues?
Yeah. So number one, you know, investing too soon, it is along the same vibe as investing works, people don't. It's the same vibe as, I'm not out of credit card debt. It's the same vibe as, I don't have a budget or system in place. So sure, you can set up an account tomorrow and invest. Sure, awesome. I want you to do that. However, if you don't have a system in place, and I don't know what car registration's like in New Zealand, but with insurance and registration here in Australia, it's probably $800 to $1,000 a year, right?
So expensive.
If you don't have systems in place, when rego comes around next year, oh, I need a grand for rego, or I'll just pull a grand out of my investment account. We're investing for the long term. That money's only been in there 6 months. The market has had a bit of a downturn. Well, now you're actually selling out at a loss to pay your stuff that you knew that you'd have to pay. I'm kind of the vibe that if you want to start investing, while you are cleaning up your mess, while you are saving for something, while you are trying to build a business, while you are trying to insert big life goal here, I talk in the book about, well, let's do something to put your skin in the game. And I kind of use the 1% rule for that. What would be an average salary in New Zealand?
I actually just looked this up. The average salary in New Zealand right now is about 70K a year.
Okay. So we go $700 is 1%, right, of 70K divided by, we'll even do 52. That's 13, call it $13 a week, right? So if you are cleaning up your mess and are getting a bit of a plan in place, and you are interested in investing, can you do that $13 a week, $10 a week? Can you do no more than $60 a month? At least that will keep you interested, keep you engaged, but also not remove you from reality that you can't put $300 a month into your investment account because you don't have an emergency fund, you've got debt, you don't have systems or plans, you're telling us you want to save and buy a new house next year. If you are interested, well, let's get you engaged and let's just have a framework involved in place. The question about investing in quality companies, it's a bit clickbaity that, like, don't invest in quality companies. What that talks to is...
Well, you got my attention. It worked.
Yeah, exactly. So really what that talks to is the single stock risk and the risks of investing in single stocks. At the moment, as at today, my equity portfolios, I've got no single stocks. I actually sold one last week. I only had one. And I do single stocks with no more than 10% of my portfolio, just out of personal interest. The reason why, and it was a quality company and I invested in it, but the problem is, you know, I don't know lots of listed companies in New Zealand, but we'll talk to Australia because that's where I am and people might have known these brands. Well, you do know some of them. So in Australia, we've got the big four banks, you know, your CBA, ANZ, Westpac, and NAB, right? So big four banks. Now you could be like, I want to buy a bank, you know, dad and pop and mum and nan and all that over the years, like, don't put money in the bank, buy the bank. So you go, okay, I'm going to put all my money into this bank here. That one bank there. Awesome. Well, what if you bought the wrong bank? What if that one did crap over the next 10 years and not crap, quote unquote, but crap or poorly in comparison? What if you pick the wrong bank? So I'm a money dude. I'm a podcaster. I'm an online business owner. I'm not a fund manager. I'm not a stock analyst. I'm not a hedge fund manager. I'm some bogan in Newcastle with a microphone. I categorically know I need to just buy broad-based indexes and not try and game the system and pick a winner. Because absolutely, I wish I put all of my money in Nvidia 4 years ago. Gosh, I wish I did. Would have went to the moon, would have been awesome. But the problem is, for every unicorn, there's probably 1,000 dogs that didn't go anywhere and lost money.
And it's easy in hindsight.
Oh, hindsight's awesome.
But I mean, at the time, did anyone know that MySpace was going to crater and that Facebook was going to be the new thing? So easy to look back and laugh at us all being friends with Tom on MySpace. But at the time, that was the hot thing and you wouldn't have known that was about to crater.
Exactly. So, yeah, I'm all for people who want to do single stocks, but I would just caution and maybe have some guardrails in place to protect yourself. Because I actually talked about in the book that if you put $10,000 or $20,000, right? You saved up all this money and you put $20,000 into a single stock. And that single stock...
It's making me nervous even you just describing that, but carry on.
Yeah. And that single stock, you picked a winner and that increased 50% in 1 year. So you made 10 grand. It's amazing. I want that. Problem is, that 10 grand, while I'll take it, I'm not allergic to money, I love a good return, that's not life-changing amounts of money over the scheme of your career, right? $10,000, if you've got a $70,000 to $100,000 income, I'm talking life-changing career. Sure, I'll take it. But the problem is, to put all of your money into that, into a place where you want to be looking for a 50% return, is way too high risk and didn't solve your problems anyway. Yeah, I did a 50% return with my 20 grand, got an extra 10 grand. Well, I still hate my job, still living week on week. Like, there's bigger fish to fry out there and you don't want to be hanging around these corners of the investing world where 50% returns are possible, because minus 50 is also very possible with that style of investment. So absolutely, I want you to buy single stocks if you want. But if you want to ask me what I think, and you kind of have, I would have some guardrails in place. And that's what I do myself. You know, I bought a company just as a bit of an interest. Oh, yeah, I'll flick some money over there. Yeah, I did well. All right, I'm taking my money, I'm going. And I just don't do that with more than, you know, 10% of my portfolio value.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so with you on that. Yeah, a little bit of spice is fine. And that's exactly what you're saying, right? You know, you wouldn't eat a spoonful of chili, but you might sprinkle some on. And that's fine, but you've just got to know the right amounts. So, okay, if someone is thinking, I want to start investing and I do want these guardrails in place, they're looking at getting going for the first time. What are some of those first steps to future-proof yourself to start off well?
Yeah, I think it comes back to the goals thing. And this is, you know, the financial advisor coming out in me. You know, why are you wanting to invest? And it may, I'll flip it the other way to explain this, because this is a real problem in Australia, right? Young people, you know, they're just told, you got to buy a property, you got to buy a property, you got to buy a property. Everyone wants to buy a frigging property. Okay. Well, why have you come here today wanting to buy an investment property? Oh, because my parents told me to do it. Oh, because this. I'm like, well, you've got a brain. What do you want to do? And that is part of the goal thing. Like, why are you investing? And I would probably say that, like, if someone's like, well, they said, if I invest, I'll have more money later in life and I need to do that to put some mechanism so I don't spend all my money. It's like, oh, maybe some extra contributions to KiwiSaver. Get on with your life. Like, I'd actually need to know a bit more about KiwiSaver, but
it's like super, but not as good.
I think it starts with the why.
Basically.
Yeah, well, and I just like, how much can I put in extra is kind of what I don't know. So it goes back to your goals. Now, if you said, oh, I'm saving to go to Europe in 2 years, so I just want to invest, like, sweet, keep the money in the cash, in the cash account. If your goal is, well, I want to build wealth in my life because I've come from a family that hasn't had money, I understand investing and all that. It's like, okay, well, let's start at an investment account and let's even, you know, we want to make sure our budget's in place. We want to make sure we've got our, like, our income insurances, because if the income stops, everything's over anyway. We want to make sure we've got an emergency fund. We want some, in the book, I talk about my sound financial house and building your financial house, much like you would build a house. Start with foundations, then the slab. Then the walls are your lifestyle goals. If you've got a lifestyle goal to start your own business and do all that stuff, maybe the money's better spent starting your own business. Then you can get that established. Then you can invest. So it does come back to the why. But if in doubt, if you've done a budget and you're like, okay, I've got an extra $500 a month that really isn't spoken for, or $200 a month, whatever that is that isn't spoken for, you probably are a candidate to park that money for long-term growth and investing. And if in doubt, put half of it in a long-term investment account and save half in cash until you really start to work what you want to do, work out what you want to do.
I liked what you said before about starting small. That's often something that I talk to people about as well, that starting small is not only worth it, because sometimes people will be like, oh, you know, how far can you get with $5? Well, pretty far for starters, especially if you stick with it. But it's also that mindset, right? And you can learn by doing. I think that's really powerful for investing. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I agree. So a lot of these investment apps, they're really great because I can get started with $20. And if it is all new for you and you've heard, oh, investing's like gambling and all this stuff that isn't true, you could literally put $25 into a broad-based index fund and just check it every week just to see it go up and down and get used to that volatility. Get used to, oh, I put $25 in there. Oh, it's only worth $20 now. Well, no. Well, you still own the same amount of units in the fund. You still own the same amount of shares. you're still getting dividends and distributions, but the face value is fluctuating. As long as you keep holding that, you're all good. So it is really good to get started with smaller amounts, because it doesn't have to be all or nothing. You could be like, oh, I've got 10 grand that, yeah, I've saved, you know, I'm happy renting here. I don't want to buy. I want to invest. Okay, well, what about you put $2,000 in and over the next 8 months, just do $1,000 a month automatic investing? Like, it's okay to walk into the water.
Yeah. And as well, you know, you're talking there about index funds. That's something that I talk about constantly. Love them. Think they're a fabulous invention. And the danger, as you were saying earlier, with the individual companies, I have dabbled with some. I do still have some in my portfolio because I liked having a little bit of spice. I liked having a couple of companies that I just was like, oh, you know, interesting. I'll check it out. Majority was index. I'd say 80% was index funds. And then I had, you know, a couple of picks. And then I had a kid. And then I had another kid. And life got really busy. And those individual companies have been totally neglected. Now, when I first invested in them, they did great. I missed the point where I would have usually cashed out because I wasn't paying attention because life was busy. And now, they're not doing great. And actually, I should probably just get on with it and sell them and cut the loss. But I'm still busy. So I just biff my automatic investment into index funds and I'm ignoring the ones that aren't doing great because I just don't have the headspace. And this is from someone who works in this space. This is from someone who pays attention for a living. So I just think, you know, when we're looking at these things, it's that it's not always the dollars, right? And it's not always just the strategy. You've also got to keep in mind your lifestyle, how much time you have, how much brain you want to put into it. And you can actually very successfully be a brainless investor. You just kind of have to admit that to yourself, right?
Oh, investing is easy. Like, it's easy. But staying invested is hard. And,
yeah,
you know, I kind of, and again, I live in reality. Like, if you're listening to this and you're a marketing manager at a corporate thing, it's like, no, you're really good at doing marketing managing. Don't think you really are really good at share investing. You might be, but I'm in money like you every day, but I know that picking single stocks doesn't actually work out. And it's the Dunning-Kruger effect. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, go on, but tell us more.
So basically, when you get started, you have all this confidence. So like the thing goes up and then over time, the confidence decreases because you learn more about it. And the more you understand that you don't know and you're a buffoon, and then you basically, they call it like the confidence gap or something like that. And I think I'm just at the Dunning-Kruger effect down the other end where I know that I know that I know.
You now know so much that you have no confidence.
That I know so much that there is no point trying to pick winners. And I'm just parking wealth for the long term. It's not sexy. I'll just focus being a really good butcher, baker, or candlestick maker and let the investing work in the background. Simple as that.
This is exactly it though, right? And I keep coming back to, I think so many people are really busy. And I even think about, you know, that the nexus of the financial world is New York, right? New York is where so much of the big stuff happens. And when you look at the big funds, the big financial analysts, almost all of them are based in New York, because even if they were based in LA, and we all know how fast the internet goes, super fast, it's too far away for them to get some of these updates and respond quick enough. That's how fast the people who are really, truly doing the day trading or whatever else, they're going that fast that they have to be in New York. Now, you're in Australia, I'm in New Zealand, we're even further. You know, the chances of us keeping up with some of these funds, who also don't get it right anyway, even with all this lightning speed, but the chances of us keeping up is slim to none. Why not just take the option of the easy, lazy path, have just as much, often more money, and a whole lot more time on your hands? I don't know. I feel like this is, I'll add one of my own investing pitfalls to your list.
I'll do it.
I think we like to overcomplicate things because we feel like it should get us somewhere, but it doesn't necessarily.
Yeah, we feel like we're doing something.
Yeah.
But no, you're not. You're just wrecking it.
Yeah. You're ruining it. Stop it. Have you broken any of these rules in your own life, though?
Yeah, absolutely. When I first started investing, you know, back, you know, when dinosaurs were walking around, at the time, the minimum parcel you could kind of buy was $2,000 and they weren't ETFs. And the first investment I purchased was like this penny stock, like real cheap company. Just every investing mistake was made and I lost about 40% of my money. I just love how we do have access to smaller entry prices with investing apps. We've got access to ETFs. I mean, far out. It's so good that you can actually just build wealth. And if you know how the ETFs work and what the underlying exposures are, you do have exposure. Like the individual stock that I recently sold is in the ASX 200 anyway. So I just sold out. It's like, well, I've still got exposure. I just can't see it. But yeah, I'm human, so I've made lots of mistakes. And my thing is, with the guardrails in my life now, I just make sure I don't make those mistakes again.
Yeah. And I think that's the beautiful thing about learning a bit more about money and learning a bit more about investments. Everyone's going to make mistakes at some point. We all make mistakes in our life all the time. But when you know what's happening and you understand what's behind it, it saves you from that panic response, right? You know the difference between a big mistake and a small mistake. And you also know the places to go to start fixing it. And I feel like saving yourself from panic is also massive, right?
Totally. Yeah. And it's funny. I've changed my philosophy on investing. And so if I was to ask you, and obviously I'm down this path and have been for some time, like if I said to you, Francis, why do you invest? Like, what would you answer to that?
Freedom.
Freedom.
Yeah. I don't want anyone telling me what to do. I want to have that freedom to walk away from toxic situations of any kind.
And you can achieve that by investing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Creating that passive income.
So I want you to now ask me why I invest.
So, all right then. Why do you invest?
Well, I invest because I've literally got a 3-point plan for my life, financial plan.
Cool.
They're really easy 3 points. Number one, I live on less than I earn. Number two, I'm a generous giver. And number three, I invest the rest. Now, when I invest the rest, the only reason I invest is to park wealth for the Glen of tomorrow. I'm doing the Glen of today a favor for the Glen of tomorrow. My investing objectives are to beat inflation, beat the cash rate, and I'm happy with a market return because that just takes all the pressure off. I'm not investing to try and make as much money as possible because I believe I can do that through my career and my personal exertion.
I love that. That's a really cool philosophy.
And this is your show and I'm a guest, but I would probably...
But go on.
If I may. We can have a debate on my show when you come on. I would say what you're investing for, you can get from your life and income.
No, that's very true. And I mean, hey, maybe I'm following your philosophy without realizing it, now going independent and stepping out on my own.
Yeah, because the thing is, if I'm investing to make money, which sure, everyone, we want to make money. The problem is greed can walk in the door. When greed walks in the door, stupidity follows, and then the third friend is broke. Like, you just do dumb things. So I've had to take a lot of pressure off to build my life and career on my terms, live on less than I earn, be a generous giver, and park excess money that I'm not consuming for the Glen of tomorrow, and I'm okay with market returns, and it will be above CPI and cash.
I love that.
Yeah, because I can't make investing solve all my problems. In the book, I talked about if you hated your job and you wanted to build enough money to build out this investment account so you could retire early, right? you'd basically need $5,000 or $6,000 a month for maybe 10 years, right, of your own capital. Number one, good luck getting that spare money. Number two, those 5 to 10 years that you're building that capital, well, you hate your life and your job anyway. So why go through it? Why don't you just change today?
Yeah. It's interesting that as well, because you mentioned earlier about the biggest investment you can make is in yourself and your career and your earning power. And that's also something that I think it's underrated. And I like this about your investing book, that you've got all these foundations laid out, because how can you invest if you don't have money to do it? But also people will often ask me, how do I balance living? How do I choose? They'll often phrase it as, how do I choose between today and tomorrow? How do I choose between living a happy life now and living a happy life tomorrow? And I think it's so important that you don't choose between the two, because of course you could get hit by a bus today, but also you're probably not going to be. So at the same time, you do have to make those plans for tomorrow. And if you approach it strategically, you can actually have both, right?
Yeah. And this is kind of what, this stuff flies in the face of the FIRE movement. Like, the traditional purists out of the States were financial independence, retire early. So like big income, frugal living, amass as much money as possible. Oh, I'm financially free. Okay. They do that for 10 years or 5 years. Most people get to that, I'm financially free. Oh, now I'm financially free. Now I can do my side hustle. Now I can do this. Now I'm like, whoa. I'm just going to fast forward 10 years and start to do that stuff now and live a balanced life that I enjoy. Because most people, and that's where they've got all these different flamingo FIRE, barista FIRE. I joked and poked the bear when I did a podcast on FIRE. I'm like, yeah, there's this thing called forklift FIRE. They've got meerkat FIRE. Like, all these things that people have just adapted because they want to identify with this movement, but that part of the movement doesn't suit them. So they adapt it. Where I'm just like, just live life on your own terms today.
I love that so much.
It's like, give me a break. Everyone who FIRES, they end up doing their own hobby and interest, and I'll do my own small business then. Most people need to do work and do output. I've met one person who's FIRED and literally acts like they're an 80-year-old retiree and they're in their 30s. They also had a very high paid tech job where they could bank $200,000 a year and build that money. Like, we live in reality, most of us, and most of the time you'll be bored and need to do something. So why slave away hating your job, hating your life? You know, I've got all this investment money. Oh, okay. Because when the push comes to shove, when you build that wealth, you'll be too scared to draw down on it because you're like, oh, I can't touch it. It's my money. And I only say that because the 70-year-olds retiring now can't spend their money because they've been in accumulation for all their life. I can't spend extra money. I can't tell my parents to spend $20,000 to go to Europe. They're not doing it. It's just money's not their problem. They've got all this money, but they don't spend it because they've been used to just living off their $1,000 a week. And a once-off $20,000 expense to go to Europe, that's absurd.
I read an article recently that was billed as a happy, inspiring story. And it made me really sad. I haven't been able to get it out of my head, actually. And I'm not going to name names about who it was. It was a high-profile New Zealander talking about, oh, we went on this big holiday, a family trip around Europe because their grandparents had died and left them all this money. And so the whole family went on this trip around Europe. Amazing. Love that for them. But they also mentioned, oh, our grandparents never left New Zealand. And then they left all this money after they died, and we went on this trip, and we know they would have loved that for us. While I kind of get what they're saying, I'm also like, your poor grandparents who worked really hard and never enjoyed that. And then the family got to go on this trip without them. Like, the grandparents didn't even get to come. And I just, it made me so sad. I was like, why didn't the grandparents travel when they could? And so, yeah, I'm really with you in terms of, you know, people can get stuck in that accumulation mode and not know how to spend. It is actually also important to know how to take the reward, right?
Totally. All I would say is, if you don't agree with my comments, they're worth what you paid for them, and you can do whatever you want because I'm sleeping just as well tonight. And that's it. Personal finance is personal. So you do you, I'll do me. And the reason that I'm doing me this way is because I'm an out of control spender that needs guide rails. And then also coaching people face to face, hundreds of people, my spending plan course has had thousands of people do it. I've actually seen what works in reality and what doesn't. So I'm just trying to save people time. And, you know, you worship money, you'll be screwed. Got to hold it loosely. I reckon I was just thinking money, I talk about in the book, like control your money, control your future, right? Money needs to be a well-trained dog that can walk with you and do as you command. And, you know, you see someone walking the dog with a leash. If the dog's pulling on the leash, taking the person for a walk, that's not a trained dog. A trained dog will walk on the leash still next to the person. You need to train your money so it's a dog that doesn't even need a leash.
I love that.
And you got to put the time in. It's very hard. Is it easy? No. Is it worth it? Yes.
All right. Perfect note to leave that on. If people don't like it, it's worth what it's paid for. And if you train it, it's worth it. If people want more of your truth bombs, where do they find you? You're online. You've got podcasts. You've got a book. Drop all of the places to find you.
Oh, gosh. Well, Money, Money, Money podcast. Instagram is moneypodcast.aus and our Money, Money, Money podcast Facebook group. Now, if you do join that group, I don't know if you've found it lately. There's so much spam.
Yeah.
It says, where did you hear about the group? Just put Francis's podcast, just so we know that you're a person and not some bot farm on the other side of the world. But yeah, the book, I can send you a link to put in the show notes if you want. It's actually a really good book. I was reading it, like the Quick Start Guide to Investing, like,
yeah,
who wrote this and what did you do with Glenn? But my co-author, Nick Bradley, who hosts our This Is Investing podcast, I said to him, I'll write this book with you, but you're doing all the technical investy stuff. So he talks about investing in single shares, how to value companies. Still, like, don't put more than 10% of your portfolio. He talks about options trading if you want to scratch that itch, thematic investing and all that. But I really nailed the mindset piece, the money management piece, the strategy piece, all the stuff that we can forget about because we just go straight into solution mode without thinking about anything.
Love it. Thanks so much for coming on. That's Glenn James. Now, if you want to get in touch with me, you can also send through a money question for a future podcast or anything else. You can find me Facebook, Instagram, TikTok as Francis Cook NZ. Also got a heap more money content on there for you. Don't forget to subscribe to Making Sense so that you never miss a trick with your money. Until next time, have a great day.
Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.